Hey, I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Mission Matters. My name is Adam Torres, and if you'd like to apply to be a guest on the show, just head on over to missionmatters.com and click on Be Our Guest to Apply. All right, so today's guest is Andrew Shapiro, and he's managing member at Lawndale Capital Management. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me on.
All right, Andrew. So I understand you're going to be speaking at the Activist Investor Conference. I know that Charlie and his team are over there throwing in New York City. So I have to start off with that. Hey, are you excited?
I am. It's always great to get back to the East Coast. I'm based out on the West Coast, and it's great to be in New York and see friends and family there while I'm also getting a chance to speak on a topic that's near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, I've been covering the conference now for the last couple of weeks. So I've had I've gotten the opportunity to get in the weeds with some of the other speakers and some of the other sponsors and things about the conference overall. And this, I couldn't make it to this one, but this would have been my first one, but we didn't get to make it to this one. But have you been to these in the past before? I'm just curious.
Well, I speak at activist investor conferences and corporate governance conferences across the country pretty regularly. This particular agenda and this conference is pretty exciting. There's some very impressive panels and topics and speakers that are attending. I think very important topics in what is somewhat an ever-changing field.
Yeah. And not holding you to this, because I know topics change, and also depending on what my audience listens to this, either you'll just be speaking on it, or you would have just spoken to it. So because this is going to be out there for a long time, but keeping it high level, what are some of the things you hope to present?
I was asked to speak on, and then we expanded the fireside chat to add another speaker on the topic who I've spoken on panels with together on the subject, which is a dual subject to why corporate boards should think like shareholder activists and what are the benefits of having an experienced activist shareholder in the boardroom as one of the directors. And so both Glenn Kaufman and myself have a lot of experience in the boardroom, and we've been able to see and witness how boards behave differently and enhance their game when individuals like he or I are part of the board.
Now, I've asked everyone that's come on this in terms of for this, I should say, particular conference catalog, just to kind of set the footing here. And I know there's variations on this. There's not just one, right or wrong answer there. But to you, activist investor, like how do you define that?
Oh, activist investing is, first off, it's the process of being hyper-focused into the process of a company's management, its corporate governance structures, the way it allocates capital. Mm-hmm. And most investors don't focus on these matters. And if they do, it's from such a high level that they're not getting involved or expressing their views. And an activist investor is someone who basically is engaged, is speaking out, is sharing their views, is pursuing a dialogue towards the better of the corporate outcomes and the corporate operational performance and financial performance. I guess that's how I would distinguish an activist investor from one who's just a passive investor. I basically, the view is that we're investing in a company and its future versus investing in a stock and a ticker symbol and some graph on the computer screen.
Yeah. And it's almost like, and I don't want to, I don't know who I'm going to butcher when I try and bring out this quote, but it was either Buffett or somebody said, like the idea of when you're buying a stock to, think about it, like you can't sell it again on an exchange quite so easily, and you had to hold it 10 years, then how would you act or how would you move or what decisions would you make? So in this sense, it almost seems like, I guess, tying back to your speaking topic and everything else, when it comes to corporate boards, why should the corporate boards really think like activists or have somebody there that does?
Sure. You know, boards should adopt the mindset of shareholder activists for several compelling reasons. First, shareholder activists often scrutinize companies with a focus on improving efficiency, transparency, and overall performance. And by thinking like an activist, corporate boards can proactively address weaknesses, they can identify opportunities for growth, and enhance shareholder value. This approach kind of promotes a culture of continuous improvement and responsiveness to market dynamics. Now, you know, you listen to that and you say, well, of course, you know, that makes sense. But I've got to tell you, I've been doing this for more than three decades. Most boards are stagnant. They don't think like this. And they get stuck in the mud. Now, secondly, adopting a shareholder activist mindset encourages boards to prioritize shareholder interests and align corporate strategies with the goal of maximizing shareholder value. So many times, and this is a focus of many an activist fight, the board is focused on entrenchment and then management self-interest, and it's not focusing on the true owners of a business, which are its shareholders, in a sense, the people who put them in their jobs. Now, that's partially a factor of, you know, a failure of the American corporate democratic or election system, where it's more like a Russian election, where there's only one slate of candidates that are put up. But, you know, thinking like an activist gets you, you can have more effective decision-making processes as boards become more attuned to the concerns and expectations of shareholders. I mean, it fosters a sense of accountability. It ensures that corporate governance is geared towards creating sustainable long-term value, which, of course, is in the best interest of both the company and all of its shareholders. And you know, lastly, if they think like a shareholder activist, this can help a board anticipate potential challenges and market trends, because activists, many investors, but activist investors in particular, often have a keen eye for identifying opportunities that traditional management might overlook. And by adopting this more proactive and strategic approach, boards can again stay ahead of the curve and navigate industry changes effectively and position the company for long-term success, rather than being so, you know, embracing the perspective of a shareholder can transform the boards into this proactive agents of positive change. As a shareholder, I'm investing in a company not for its past performance, but what it could do in the future. And I'm looking forward thinking. And that's what we need boards to think like as well, to drive continuous improvement and deliver value to shareholders.
What do you think sometimes leads boards to becoming complacent, or to complacency? Because you have a lot of boardroom experience. And what do you think causes that?
I think the main thing that causes that is the fact that there is a tenuous chain of accountability between the shareholders and the board members. The job doesn't seem to have a threat or a risk. In other words, board members get appointed and they kind of get reappointed and reappointed. Some boards and companies have entrenchment mechanisms of what we call classified or staggered boards. So they have multi-year terms. And if the board is staggered, it takes at least two full years. Let's say it's a nine-person board and they're three-year terms. You're going to have one class of directors of three every 3 years. So it takes at least 2 years for a majority of the board to get voted out of office and replaced. So if all the board members were up for annual election, you could prospectively remove or change a majority of the board in a single year. That would be more accountable than the classified or staggered boards. But moreover, there are all kinds of impediments that are placed by corporations in their bylaws as to the rules and the factors that enable or disable the ability of shareholders to call a special meeting, perhaps to cause a change in the board sooner than when the meeting's scheduled, or the ability of shareholders to even make nominations of alternative board candidates. There's new rules that were recently adopted, thankfully, called Universal Proxy Card, UPC rules, that now enable shareholders using the proxy card they are sent to vote at annual meetings of corporations that they would otherwise not attend in person. It allows them to select amongst both alternate board candidates that might be put up by an activist investor, as well as the company's nominated board candidates, all in one proxy card, where before you have to attend the meeting in person to have that choice. So you were always stuck with voting the blue card or the yellow card, management slate, or the activist slate. So in the upcoming Disney proxy contest, as a result of the new universal proxy card rules, there'll be one proxy card that will contain all candidates from Nelson Peltz and Jay Rasulo, the nominees of Trian, to the nominees put forth by Blackwell's, another shareholder, Disney, to the Disney slate. And shareholders can evaluate all the candidates, and then they can choose their top nine or top whatever the number is of board seats to select what they think would be the optimal combination of skills and experiences to be put on the board. And so that was a new positive rule change that better enables shareholders to be able to do that. Now, of course, that frankly raises the importance of perhaps having experienced activist investors or experienced shareholder advocates as part of the board. And the reason for that is, since it's going to be easier and less costly for activists to target individual weak directors for replacement, it raises the importance for expedited and recurring internal scrutiny of the board's composition and the relevancy of each board member's skills and experience for the company's future needs. Boards more than ever will now need to have the right skills and experiences to address the issues on the minds of shareholders. And that's before some activist forces such change with their candidate. So frankly, I think there's no better board member now to spearhead such engagement efforts of the board with its shareholders than a board member with activist experience and skills.
In your career, I mean, you led one of the longest running activist hedge funds. So you brought up Disney. That's one case, which you're welcome to go further into it if you'd like. Or just in general, is there any other company or situation that you're following right now that you find interesting?
You know, I had been following the Choice Hotels attempted takeover battle for Wyndham Hotels, as I was a finalist to be on the Choice Hotels alternative board slate. Now, they went a different direction and nominated the particular slate they did. But that was a very interesting case because Choice was proposing to elect a slate of new directors onto the board of Wyndham. And from the and I raised this issue with Choice, from the moment Choice spent all that money to get people elected, you know, to campaign and proxy solicit, et cetera, to get people elected to that board. Now, they did drop their campaign as of this morning. Here they spend all that money, but the moment I would have been elected, I raised this issue with them, the moment I'm elected to that board of Wyndham, I am a board member of Wyndham, and my job and duty, ironically, is to maximize value for all Wyndham shareholders. Choice Hotels own some shares. That's how they had the right to nominate directors. But I'd have a duty, and I raised this issue, I have the duty to basically extract from Choice Hotels a higher or their best offer and potentially find and get a higher valued alternative than their bid. Because my goal and job would be to maximize value on behalf of all the Wyndham shareholders, despite the fact that Choice would have gone through all that pain and suffering and effort and fight to get me and the rest of that Choice Hotels alternative board slate elected. Now, with UPC, I don't think the Wyndham shareholders would have elected a full clean slate, a new slate anyway. I think they would have elected only a minority slate of a minority of the new nominees, maybe two or three people at most. I think I would have been someone that would have been great for that, because I have devoted a career of focusing on maximizing shareholder value. Mm-hmm. So I would have been a great representative for all Wyndham shareholders, put on even by choice to help maximize the value for all the Wyndham shareholders.
That's a great example. And following kind of the Disney situation, I just want to circle back to that one briefly. Does this, like, depending on what happens, is there, what are some of the implications of, like, people using this almost as a case study when something like that happens in a company like Disney? From your experience, what do you think? Well, this is our crystal ball time, let's say. I'm not holding you to it.
Sure. Well, when you're dealing with, you know, saying like a case study on this, mm-hmm. this proxy contest is not all that different from the proxy contest that we have led or been involved with over the last 30 years. You know, there's a case by case, you know, claims that are being made that, but basically the argument Trian, Nelson Peltz's group, is that the board has too beholden to the C-suite, that this is Bob Iger's board, that the board has overly delegated its responsibilities either to management or has been a rubber stamp. Case in point, Trian has argued that the compensation that has been provided to Iger in the past by this board has been excessive, and they allege that it's been misaligned with the interests of shareholders. One item they raise, note, I'm not a Disney shareholder. I don't have an axe to grind per se in this case, but I have made these claims and fights in other proxy contests and battles in the companies that I've invested in over time. One of the complaints was that, you know, Iger was the instrumental in Disney paying billions upon billions of dollars for Fox. And it's not clear that that acquisition has even come close to generating an adequate return on the amount paid. Yet the comp committee granted Iger a $200 million, don't hold me to the exact amount, but it was, but it's $100 or more million dollars of a bonus just for completing the acquisition, rather than having such a bonus be, let's say, deferred over time based on the actual performance of the acquisition. Because that way, the alignment of interest with the shareholders would be that you don't overpay, that you only expand the empire and grow the universe in a shareholder value accretive way. So many times the imperial CEOs that I have fought throughout my career have been growing the empire because more often than not, compensation committees rely on compensation consultant studies that compare what the compensation levels are of companies of similar size. And as companies are larger, compensation levels tend to be larger. So if you grow the empire with an acquisition, it's one way of basically growing your CEO comp down the road. So when you did it and you granted the bonus on just the closing and completing of the acquisition, it didn't really weigh whether or not it was a good acquisition or not. So that's one kind of interesting consideration. Another thing I know Trian raised, I was recently at a Council of Institutional Investors spring meeting in D.C. where Peltz made a presentation to the council members, and I'm an associate member of the council, and I was there. He made the argument that, you know, with a good deal of time left on Bob Iger's new employment agreement, the board was conducting trying to create a new succession plan because the former succession plan that Mr. Iger had spearheaded, resulting in Bob Chapek, was a disaster. That after only 4 months, the Disney board decided to give Iger another 2-year extension and cut the succession plan development process short. Now, that raises an interesting issue. Why did the Disney board do that so soon with so much time left on Iger's new contract? You don't see that in sports with free agency, mm-hmm. that they necessarily do it. You could have gone further towards the end of his contract. You could have taken more time trying to find and seeing if there was an adequate successor for him before you gave this, gave the extension. So either the board panicked, which doesn't say much about the board and argues that mm-hmm. perhaps Tryon's argument for some board change is needed, or with a wink and a nod, Mr. Iger kind of told the board, well, I'd like to continue doing this, and so maybe we should, you know, cut this process short and put it off for another few years. Mm. So either way, the board was either beholden or they panicked. And either way, it doesn't sound, it didn't seem good to me if I was a Disney shareholder. I entered Mr. Peltz's presentation with some skepticism. I left that presentation feeling a little bit more that if I was a Disney shareholder, you know what? I think I might, you know, vote for a small change in the board, because that's all they're asking is two mm-hmm. people exit and Nelson Peltz and Jay Rasulo get added onto the board. So, mm-hmm. you know, one might argue, what's the harm? You know, someone argued, well, it could be disruptive. I don't know if Mr. Peltz is all that disruptive in the boardroom. You know, what I've seen over years has been pretty value added.
Hmm. Wonderful. Well, Andrew, this is, I'm excited to continue to watch these developments unfold and just to kind of reflect back on these conversations that I've had and just to see it all play out as you've seen these things all play out many, many times in your career. That being said, if somebody is listening to this or watching this and they want to, you know, they want to follow your journey and learn more, what's the best way for people to connect?
Well, I mean, they can follow me on X, the social site formerly known as Twitter, mm-hmm. at one, that's Lawndale and the number one, or they can follow me on LinkedIn, I guess, and that's a way they could, you know, prospectively reach out as I migrate myself into the second act of my career as we wind down our activist funds after 32 years. When we wind this thing down, and I'm looking forward to serving on more boards, which I've started to do with some private startup companies already.
Fantastic. And looking forward to continue to watch your journey unfold. And for everybody that's listening to this, I will put the link to Andrew's LinkedIn, of course, in the show notes and all that, so you can just connect, and also on Twitter so you can connect with Andrew. And also to the audience, if this is your first time with Mission Matters or engaging in an episode, we're all about bringing on business owners, entrepreneurs, and executives and having them share their mission, the reason behind their mission, their work, and, you know, what we can all learn from that so that we can all grow together. If that sounds interesting to you or fun or exciting, hit that subscribe button, because we have many more mission-based individuals coming up the line, and we don't want you to miss a thing. Andrew, again, thank you so much for your time today and for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Adam. It was a pleasure.